This is Richard Verone, and I'm conducting an oral history interview with Colonel Jack Keith. I am in Lubbock, Texas, at Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech University. And, Mr. Keith, you are in Miami, Florida, is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. Sir, this morning, if you would, and it is October 24th, on Thursday morning. If you would, sir, let's start with some general biographical information. Where were you born, and when were you born?
I was born in Muskegon, Michigan.
Uh-huh.
24 September 1924.
Okay, okay. And did you grow up there in Michigan, or?
Yes, I hardly left town there.
Really?
Until I was 18 years old.
Is it a relatively small town, or?
It's on the west coast of Michigan, right across from Milwaukee. Probably, I think the documents give it a figure of something like 40,000, 50,000.
Okay, okay. How would you describe your childhood there?
I was one of three children. My father was a independent garageman. My mother was a nurse. I thought it was real fine. Partially during the Depression, there things were a little tough, but
yes, sir.
I always had plenty to eat. There was no problems. I hardly realized that there was. A depression, and just went on through the school system until 1943 when I graduated there at the high school.
Okay. So both of your parents worked?
And yes, they did.
Okay. What did you do? Did you work during your youth there?
Not really. The only work I did, I'd say about the last year before I left, I was still in school, and I drove a railway express truck.
Okay.
It's similar to these FedEx and things like today.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that was about the extent of my work.
Okay. Sir, what do you remember about high school? What were your favorite subjects, and were you involved in sports and things like that?
Not really. With the war on there, beginning in 41, I wanted to get out and get in the service, and I was interested in aviation, so...
Mm-hmm.
I actually didn't. I took extra subjects and so on to get through a little early. And so I very little involvement with any extracurricular type things. In fact, I think they indicated in the yearbook that I never looked back and just marched straight through.
Okay.
So that was it.
What were your favorite subjects in high school?
I guess math, primarily, I guess. I never... was really thrilled over schooling. In the last few years, I wanted to get out and get over and get into the World War II.
Okay. Why were you interested in the military? Did you have military tradition in your family, or was it something that you had yourself?
My father was in World War I, enlisted man, worked with the quartermaster corps, I think it was. And of course, he was proud that he served, and then, of course, in this war, World War II came along. I was the only one. My brother was about 4 years younger, so he wasn't going to make it. And, but my dad was, you know, he wanted us to, if we were of the right age, you know, he wanted us to, you know, get in there and do what he did. So I was interested in aviation from way back by just, you know, hanging around the airport and getting a flight or two with a friend of my father's. And So one day he came home and mentioned something about aviation. He had talked to the major down at the armory, and that was it. I signed up, and they allowed me to continue on until I graduated, and then they called me in as an aviation cadet.
Okay, so you signed up before you graduated high school?
Yes.
Okay. And you knew you wanted to go into the Air Force?
That's right.
Or to the, I guess...
U.S. Army Air Corps at that time.
Exactly. How did you get interested in aviation? You said it started when you were younger.
Yes. Like my father with his garage, he's in a mechanic there too, and I don't know, maybe Lindbergh or Wrongway Corrigan, the man flew to Ireland, you know. And then there was a friend. My father's had a little aircraft, and he gave us a ride, and I flew with, had a quick flight with a man named around with a Ford tri-motor, and I got a ride in that, and I just began to kind of think, you know, this is okay,
mm-hmm.
and that's the way I went.
Were you ever scared or nervous of flying, being up in the air?
No, never was.
Okay. I guess you can't be if you're going to fly
so
much. You know, you need to not have that kind of fear. Okay, so after you graduated high school, this was, I guess, in June of 43?
That's right.
Okay, and you immediately went to basic?
Right.
Okay, and where was your basic training?
Yeah, I graduated from high school there in 15 June,
mm-hmm.
and 5 July I left, and I went to Keesler, Mississippi.
Okay. How would you describe your basic training?
kind of a big thrill to me, first time I'd been away from home.
Uh-huh.
And I just did everything they told me to do, and mm-hmm. along with a lot of these other 18-year-olds,
mm-hmm.
and I enjoyed it.
Was it really difficult for you, or
no.
physically, or anything?
No, I kind of went for the calisthenics and all of the
mm-hmm.
things that they put us through, and
mm-hmm.
Food and everything was fine, and
mm-hmm.
you're kept so busy, you didn't get a chance to think of home or anything else, really. It was
right.
day by day.
Right. Did your training focus on World War II and what was happening and, you know, where you might be going after you finished basic?
Yes. I'm trying to think. I think that's where we got into. It was primarily, I think code, Morse code, and all these, the recognition
mm-hmm.
of all the aircraft and ships of the world
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
we were involved in, that came a little later. So I think basic training was just primarily physical.
Okay. So how long was your basic? It lasted?
About 6 weeks.
6 weeks, okay. Mm-hmm. And from there, where did you go?
Yeah, from there I went to Fort Ethan Allen, or up in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
They had a college training program they had. They call it CTD.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a kind of a sidetrack. Things are slowing down a little bit, even then, 1943. And
mm-hmm.
So rather than to jump right into the flying end of it, they would partition us off into these sidetracks in the colleges. So I spent a semester at the University of Vermont
mm-hmm.
before getting back into the system.
What did they teach you there for that one semester?
Pretty much math, science, history, English.
Okay.
Went into the medical business a little bit, things like that. And again, there was a lot of calisthenics.
Okay. When did you first get behind into the cockpit to fly?
Yeah, that was when we went to primary flight training in Helena, Arkansas in May
mm-hmm.
of 1944.
Okay. So, all right, before that, after you left the college training in Vermont,
uh-huh.
where did you go from there?
Yeah, we went to Nashville, Tennessee, which was a cadet classification center where
uh-huh.
they determine whether you're going to be a pilot, bombardier, navigator.
Okay. And this is January 1944?
Right. This
correct?
January and February.
Okay. And how did they, did you get to select what you wanted to do, or did they select you?
They select you. They had all kinds of written examinations that
mm-hmm.
you took, and
mm-hmm.
it depended on how you made out on those, which way you went, whether pilot or otherwise. Of course,
mm-hmm.
I always wanted the pilot bit, and I was always kind of worried that, you know, you might get something different. So I don't know what I'd have done if that had happened, but I was lucky, and I
uh-huh.
managed to stay into that.
Okay. And so you were assigned to fly fighter pilots, or just
that,
you were pilot?
At that point, they just call it single engine.
Okay. So you qualified for that. I take it your eyesight was up to par.
Yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
And if you had done really well on all the exams, but your eyesight was not what they wanted,
uh-huh.
you would have been out. Is that correct?
That's right.
Wow. Okay. So you're blessed with good eyes.
That's right.
Good. So, all right, after, this is in Nashville, and you're there for a couple of months, and from there, where do you go?
Yeah, there again, like that CTD up there where
mm-hmm.
they put you on the side rail,
mm-hmm.
they sent us to oh, February, March of that, we went to Mariana, Florida,
mm-hmm.
Air Base, and again, you know, March time, and waiting to go to Maxwell Field, which was actually the primary flight business where you really, you know, get into it.
Right, and at this point, you still had not flown.
No.
Where, I guess, were you itching to get it behind the...
Oh, yeah. Every once in a while, you'd see an aircraft, they had a P-40
mm-hmm.
land, and we'd kind of sneak around and go out and try to take a look, and things like that.
Uh-huh. And what did you do there in Florida? What was
Florida
your training?
Was just practically nothing. It was just at calisthenics again and that type of thing,
mm-hmm.
and three meals a day,
mm-hmm.
and I don't recall any studying much of any kind.
How much contact did you have with your family through these first year or so?
Never saw them at all for 19 months, but
wow.
But I would write regularly, so
mm-hmm.
there wasn't any problem there. And I don't recall really calling much. It was always writing a letter.
Mm-hmm. I take it your father, since he encouraged you to enlist, and your mother, I guess, were they supportive of your military career at this point?
Yeah. Yeah, they're behind me all the way.
Okay. How about your brother?
Yeah, he was fine. He was still had 3 years or so of school to go,
mm-hmm.
so he was kind of busy.
Right. Did you have any other siblings?
Yes, I had a sister a year older.
Okay, and how did she feel about you being in the service?
Yeah, she was behind me all the way. She was a registered nurse like my mother.
Okay. And so basically at this point, this is early 1944, of course before the invasion of Europe.
Uh-huh.
Did you feel like the war was kind of passing you by? Did you want to get over in the fight, or?
Yes, you know, that was the big thing. You know, we heard of all the kills in you know, air-to-air kills
mm-hmm.
in the Pacific by the Navy and things like that, and
mm-hmm.
And it was all great news that way. And then all I could think of was, geez, you know, I hope it's not over, you know, before I can get in
mm-hmm.
in the fight.
Mm-hmm. But, You wrote in your memoirs that you sent us that it's really you think that it's every aviator's dream, or really every, you know, when you're in military service, you know, it's a privilege to be able to serve in these conflicts, that you kind of, you wait for these conflicts to come up, and when they do, you want to get out there and do your duty.
That's right. That's what we live for.
Yeah. Okay, so... You're in Florida for a couple of months, and then in March 44, you're transferred to Maxwell Field?
Right.
Okay. And so you're finally at the, where they're going to teach you some more straightforward, I guess, aviation.
Right.
Okay. What was your training like there?
Yeah, here was the same thing in the calisthenics again, real rigorous. And the big thing here was memorizing Morse code. We had to identify all
mm-hmm.
aircraft and naval vessels of all countries,
mm-hmm.
ours and all the enemies and the friendlies.
Was that difficult to do?
It was kind of rough at times, but it was, again, fun, and
mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
But that was primarily it for, see, that went on for, oh, March through May, I guess it was.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. I enjoyed that because at that point, you know, we knew that the next step was going to be into an airplane.
Right.
Primary flight training.
Right. Okay. Were you able to make friends throughout this early training? Did you have any good friends?
Not in those early years. You may have one or two individuals that had similar life as your own, and,
mm-hmm.
and like on a weekend, you know, somebody to walk to town with.
Mm-hmm.
Everything you did, you had to walk,
right,
or take a bus or something. But
uh-huh.
Not over, like, say, one or two people like that.
Mm-hmm.
On most of the stations that I was assigned, where you would have that guy to go to the movies with, or,
mm-hmm.
or go get a mm-hmm. hamburger with, or so.
Mm-hmm. What did you enjoy doing when you were had your downtime?
That was about it. Probably go downtown, look around the Red Cross. You know, they give you donuts and,
mm-hmm.
and coffee and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess occasionally a movie,
mm-hmm.
but not too much on the movie. But I think it was just kind of looking around and
right.
seeing the local areas.
Right.
I remember one time we was a prison camp, German prison camp near our primary base. And,
is this in Alabama?
No, this is my next stop.
Okay, in Arkansas?
Right.
Okay.
So when we went into Helena, Arkansas, I had a friend there, a guy named Henry Peters, and he was a German extraction and real nice type, and he's the type that I would go in and out of town with and get a ice cream and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he heard of this camp, so we walked over to it and stopped it, laid outside of the fence, and the guards up on the guard shack watched us.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, during the war, you could never take off your uniform as far as on or off base.
Right.
They knew or saw that we were cadets, so they just kind of turned away, and we chatted, and Henry's folks, I think his father was born in Germany, so these German prisoners kind of started to come up along the fence on the opposite side, and we'd just sit in the grass, and Henry would talk to him and speak to him in German. And
really?
When they found out his father was German, German-born, they just had a real great conversation, and they had a volleyball going, and and that terminated about that time, and the only individuals that didn't come over looked like some of the old hardened types,
right,
who just kind of walked by with their hands placed behind them, you know, looking over in disgust at their fellow Germans who would sit and talk to the American, you know.
Right.
So that was an interesting little episode.
What did they talk about? Do you remember?
Yeah, I don't know. about the families and, one thing that was interesting, I don't know if I mentioned it there, was the Germans, they worked in the cotton fields and in other crops there.
Mm-hmm.
And they, of course, there wasn't any activity. They'd hear our little primary planes flying over when they're out in the fields. In fact, we would fly over and wag wings or dive down towards them, and they'd wave and all this type thing.
Hmm.
And they told us that they knew that this whole area where they were imprisoned there was just a setup, like Hollywood front, you know, and that we were all starving to death and all and about to succumb to the Nazi and the Axis powers, you know. And so Henry kind of laughed, and he said, "Well, no, you're wrong." And but he couldn't convince them. They thought it was just a fluke there set up to hide our bad deal.
Really? So they thought that at this point they were winning the war.
That's right.
Wow. Okay. So back to your training, you transfer. This is in Arkansas, Helena, Arkansas.
Right.
And this is where your primary flight training took place?
That's right.
What was that like for you?
That was great. We had the same schooling again, you know, we would fly in the morning and school in the afternoon or vice versa. And we had this little PT-19 aircraft, single engine. And we had five of us under our particular instructor, who was a civilian instructor. And we'd go out and fly with him each day, and giving us instructions, and we'd get up around 10 hours, and then he'd crawl out and let you go alone. But he would, the guys, for some reason, they tended, especially in the initial business area, you haven't flown yet, they try to tear you down and scare you to death. Like, well, you know, like my guy says, "Well, get in there and go." He says, "You're going to kill yourself. I'm not going with you." And then he turned me loose. And boy, at that point, you know, you're about ready to say, "Gee, if I'm that bad, let's forget it."
But, right.
But I went ahead and made the flight, and the rest of the guys followed right quick.
Were you the first one?
Right. I was the first of the five. I don't know if it was alphabetically. I was where Keith, Kelly, Casaritas, and so on. And I think Keith was the first one on the alphabet, so I don't know just how they managed that.
How did you feel when you first were able to fly?
Oh, it was great. You know, it was a grass patch and kind of bumpy. And when he crawled out, he strapped his parachute down in the cockpit. And then as I turn around and go out there, of course you had no radios then. You just look at the tower and wait for a green light. And when I got the green light, I pushed the power on, and of course the airplane bumped and bounces around like a cork. And I finally airborne and shot a couple of rectangular traffic patterns and then came back in and landed.
So you're up for just a few minutes?
Yeah, probably 10, 15 minutes. And they always told us that when you come in and seek the ground there on your landing, if you bounce, they said, rather than try to recover where you can get behind the power curve and you begin to over the control and everything, they said, just put the power on and go around.
Okay.
And so I did. I came in and bounced. It wasn't any problem. You know, a few hours later, it would have been no problem at all for me. But the fact that he said, you bounce, you go around. So I did.
So you bounced once and
went around. I bounced once and went around. And then we had our boy, Casaritas, who was the last son. He went in, came around 17 times before he hit the ground, you know.
Bounced. Oh, my gosh.
And he was almost out of fuel when he finally got it down.
Wow, wow.
But that's
did you guys give him a hard time about that?
Oh, yeah. He had told the instructor and all of us that he had had a little time, you know, in airplanes. And, of course, we had one man that did have, a guy named Kelly. And he could have gone out and had no problem. He probably had several hundred hours. But this guy, Casaritas, because he was kind of mouthy and like this, the instructor made a point to send him up last. And then, of course, when he finally got out after 17 tries to hit the ground, the old instructor looked at him and said, yeah, you know, a previous time. But I understand the man washed out later in advanced training.
Okay. So how many flights did you make in this training here? This was a daily event?
Right.
Okay.
I probably ended up with, I'd say probably a little less than 50 hours maybe.
Okay.
Like that.
Okay. Did you feel like you'd received good training there initially?
Yes. Yeah, I thought that was fine.
Okay. So how long were you there?
Yeah, it was about May through July.
Okay.
Of 1944.
Okay. And in July of 44, I guess, did you graduate or did they just kind of move you on?
Yeah, you just sit around and wait for orders going to basic flight training. Which I got in early August in Greenwood, Mississippi.
So describe that to me.
Yeah. They took us in trucks, six-bys, they call them. Large canvas-covered jobs, and took us into town, put us on the train. And we went from Helena, Arkansas to Greenwood, Mississippi. And in that route was where one of our cadets walked off the train at night.
He walked off the train?
Yeah. What had happened, we had, I don't know, maybe six or eight cars.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we don't know. You never told anything. We eat and sleep on the train.
Right.
And, somewhere in the night, they stopped, which they did frequently for various things, and they stopped and uncoupled the train, and they sent three or so, or half of the cars over to this twin engine base. And then we continued on. And this friend of ours, we call him Leaky, because he's always going to the boys' room. And so he would get up and go back through the back of the car and step across into the next car where they had the latrine, and then he would use that and come back. And they uncoupled it right there. And somewhere, probably early hours of the morning, he went back, pitch dark, and stepped off the back of the train while we were moving.
Oh, boy.
And then when we got to Greenwood, Mississippi, they always have a head count, and this guy was missing.
Okay.
And then the guys figured, well, he must have went back in one of the other cars to sleep with maybe a friend or something. And then they checked the police stations and so on the towns behind us, and they found that he was in the hospital. And we didn't see him for several weeks. And he was much lighter, peak is probably, I don't know him now, he probably had broken bones or so.
Mm-hmm. But he rejoined you eventually?
Yeah, he rejoined us, but I don't remember anything after that regarding him.
Okay. Okay. So what was your training like here? This was your advanced training?
No, that's
or this is your basic flight training?
Basic, okay. We went into what they call a BT-13,
mm-hmm.
same single engine.
Okay.
A little more power, a little nicer airplane, and went through the similar, you know, a few rides and then the solo.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went on to various things like navigation, landing at night, and things like that,
mm-hmm.
and just a lot of maneuvering,
mm-hmm.
just to, you know, become proficient in the airplane every day. And again, half the day was groundwork, schooling, and things like that.
Right. Okay. How many hours do you think you logged?
I probably got probably 70 or so in there.
Okay. Okay. You feel like you received good training there?
Oh, yes. It was really good.
Okay. Was the military service at this point what you thought it would be? You've been in now, for a year and a half or so?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, I thought everything was fine.
Mm-hmm.
We got a little hazing and stuff like that
mm-hmm.
on occasion, but it was all, to me, 18 years old is a big kick.
Right, right.
I thought, well, this is great, you know.
Right, and you're traveling basically all over the South here.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so from Greenwood, Mississippi, you're there until November 44.
Right.
And you're transferred to Craig Field in Alabama.
That's right.
And this was your advanced flight training.
That's right.
Okay. And what aircraft did you train in there, sir?
Yeah, we flew the AT-6,
okay.
which is a North American bird. A little jacked up, a little higher than the basic bird. It had retractable gear and mm-hmm. controllable prop and things like that, which
mm-hmm.
the birds in the past did not have. So it was in it. It was a fine airplane, and they still talk about it today as being a great trainer, you know,
okay.
before the jet business.
Mm-hmm. And any other aircraft did you train in there besides the AT-6?
No, there I went on through the program, graduated in class of 44K,
mm-hmm.
and we watched the bulletin board every day for they're sending people to Europe and back at Pacific.
Okay,
and,
so this is where you could have gotten into the fight. You could
right.
have been transferred overseas.
Right. I still had the rest of 45 before the VE day was May of 45.
Yes, sir.
And J-Day was September.
Right.
But, so we really hounded that bulletin board every hour. And in the meantime, we're flying P-40s.
Okay.
Curtis Warhawk, they call them. And that was a real fine airplane. When a lot of the old jocks look back today, you know, they say it was kind of austere, but
mm-hmm.
but it was all right. And then we went into the P-40 or the P-47D, which were brand new birds with the bubble canopy,
mm-hmm.
and right out of the factory, never been in combat.
Mm-hmm.
And so we I flew those for several months and enjoyed those. Had a ball, used to get in trouble buzzing and things like that.
Tell me about that. What would you guys do?
Oh, we kind of had dusted off an Army housing place down Rucker, I think, Alabama, down in there somewhere around Napier Field
mm-hmm.
in Alabama at Dothan. And a friend of mine, a boy named Latimer Briggs Neal, the third, we called him Pappy because he was 27.
Okay.
I was 20 when I graduated.
Okay.
And so we referred to him as Pappy. And he had a sister living down there at this Army housing area.
Mm-hmm.
And she was married to an Army type.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we were still Army Air Corps. But,
right, right.
But the Army guys, if they weren't in the Air Corps, they didn't have too much love for us. So we went off on a cross country and two different airplanes, and he briefed me that we'll kind of dust that place off to show his sister that he was around.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did. And just it scared everybody to death. And when I look at it now, I thought, my God, that was terrible. Because you're right down clothesline level.
Wow.
Taking the roofs off and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
About to be, and then make it worse, we made about six passes apiece.
Wow.
And then we went on to Atlanta and spent the night, and then came back and did them again about two deal on a Sunday, that was Saturday and Sunday. And
mm-hmm.
then we got back and landed, and everything we thought was great. And I being single, lived in the BOQ,
mm-hmm.
and Briggs lived in town with his wife mm-hmm. and a newborn boy. So when he got home, he got a call from his sister.
Mm-hmm.
Said things are kind of bad, that she'd heard a woman in the hallway on the telephone talking to Napier Fields about a couple of people that were really tore the base up.
Mm-hmm.
So he came right out to the base and briefed me on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went in. Briggs learned that some of this is kind of touchy, but I mean, it's been so many years now, I'm okay.
Mm-hmm.
But, he came in and gave me the whole picture, and he wanted to go turn us in. You know, we ought to go turn ourselves in. I thought, we can't do that, because in those days, you could be court-martialed, or they fine you forever. And
okay.
So I said, let's tell them we got lost, and we went down looking for the railroad station. That was the procedure in those days. If you got lost, you'd buzz the railroad station and read the name off the station.
Okay.
And like Lubbock, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then so we gave this, went in and told the operations officer, who was the captain.
Mm-hmm.
And we told him the story, and he said, ah, fine, you know, that's okay. You know, you did the right thing. And in the meantime, I took off on another thing, ferrying aircraft. And so at that point, the paper followed us, and they were back at our air base.
Mm-hmm.
And then they contacted this captain
mm-hmm.
and so on. And, of course, at that point, he knew what it was all about. And initially, he was really happy with us. You know, he did everything right. At this point, he knew that we had made a mess of things. So
right.
He said, well, I know what happened, so, you know, get out of my sight type thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we just got the story together and about the buzzing, looking for the town name off the railroad station. And
mm-hmm.
Colonel Clifton was the commander, and his assistant, another full colonel, were away. And they came back. They were told of this, about our story that we had given the mm-hmm. legal office. And
mm-hmm.
We never heard a word of it.
Really?
All I could imagine was that they tried to instill this afraid of nothing, aggressiveness, and so on with mm-hmm. the fighter pilots,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I thought, well, maybe the colonels kind of felt, well, they're programmed pretty good, you know. so we never heard it. Just terribly lucky.
Right. So you got all free. Nothing
yes.
problems at all.
Uh-huh.
Did his sister, your friend's sister, she heard you guys come over and
oh, yeah.
knew that it was him?
She, I think, I don't know if they had done any telephone work prior to this thing or
mm-hmm.
not, but
mm-hmm.
I think she kind of knew what it was.
Wow.
And then, of course, when she called, Selma, where Briggs lived with his wife, and
mm-hmm.
was assured.
Okay, so you graduated in May of 1946.
February of 45.
I'm sorry, February 45, and you stayed on there, Craig Field, for a while?
Until May of 46.
Okay.
At this time, things are getting real rough, you know. The pilots were just, whether you wanted to stay or not, they just lined up and you went home. And
oh, really?
That's
so
right.
They're discharging people.
Oh, yeah. They're falling like leaves off a tree in the
mm-hmm.
fall.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I'd say the majority of them look forward to it. You know, they want to get back, get to
right.
work with their dads or go to college and things like that.
Right.
But there are a bunch of us that loved aviation, loved
mm-hmm.
the business.
Mm-hmm.
I just held my breath, and things really got tight. And we found about that time at Craig in early 46,
mm-hmm.
if you didn't have some kind of an additional duty, like a lot of the fighter pilots after you graduate, all you did was fly.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have any little crazy jobs like an assistant maintenance officer or assistant to the PX officer or whatever it might have been.
Right.
And we heard that to get into radar was a keeper.
Uh-huh.
And another one was the Hollybird Signal Depot in Baltimore. It was a intelligence spook school, spy school.
Uh-huh.
And that sounded kind of intriguing, and I didn't have a feel for being a radar type, so
uh-huh.
I grabbed that and went off to Baltimore.
Okay. And this
At that point, I was still flying P-40s and P-47s.
Okay. So you did this so you could make sure you stayed in the service.
Yeah, because we could tell there on the base that, boy, our days are numbered.
You really did think that was it?
Yeah, I thought this is the only thing that tied me over.
Okay. And so how long were you in Baltimore?
Yeah, and I went to Baltimore and Hollybird, and I checked with the people there, and they said, well, we're going to have interviews with, like we're having here today, with you and anyone else, any of the other officers who are coming in to see if you're going to make a good candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point there, I met a man named Tracy B. Matheson III.
Mm-hmm. Sir, are you there?
Just a minute.
Okay. Okay, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, he was a fine young officer. We're both first lieutenant,
mm-hmm.
and he came from another base, but
mm-hmm.
under the same thing I was under. I'd never met him up to this point.
Mm-hmm.
So they called me, and I went in, set for this colonel, full colonel, and he gave me a briefing on what this school was all about and what we would do afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up by saying, of course, you know, you lose your wing.
Oh, if you went to the school.
Yes. And, of course, he was in the, I think, Signal Corps.
Mm-hmm.
He had the flags up there versus our wings, you know,
mm-hmm.
and his lapel.
Mm-hmm.
So I almost felt he was kind of pleased to tell us that, you know, the old business, that they never had too much love for the flyboys.
Uh-huh.
So when he said that, I thought, geez, you know, I don't like this at all. No, and I wouldn't be interested. And he said, okay, you're excused, and with his paperwork. And shortly after, he called in Tracy, and Tracy went through the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, he about painted too when he mentioned that no wing bit.
Right.
And so I thought two things there. That one deal, they may have selected us just for spite, you know, just to bring us out of the flying business and
mm-hmm.
get into that deal.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing, they may just go ahead and release us, but I thought that more than likely we'll probably try to keep us.
Okay.
So we checked the board, and sure enough, both of us were relieved of that assignment.
Okay.
And so at that point, we were free. We had no base. The only base we had behind us, if we went back, would probably put us out. That would discharge us.
Okay.
But we were free for anybody who might have an opening for pilot.
Right.
And old Tracy said, gee, a guy named Beverly, Colonel Beverly, is firing up the fourth group at Andrews.
Mm-hmm.
They're at Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
The fourth group is one of the hottest groups around and still is.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, why don't we drive out there and see if we can find him? And they had just brought in their equipment and things from Europe
mm-hmm.
as the war ended there. And Beverly came in from assignment around the country or somewhere and was going to be the new commander, and a real nice guy. And so we went to Andrews, far cry from what it is today. And they had a bunch of old tire paper shacks, and we saw this colonel directing and telling them where to put the boxes and stuff like that. So we walked up to him and asked him if he could use a couple of fighter pilots.
Mm-hmm.
And, boy, he turned around and said, yeah, have you flown before? And I said, yes, sir. And old Tracy said, yes, sir, too, but he hadn't flown fighters.
Okay.
But he wasn't about to say no. So
okay.
He said, well, the hitch is, who are you assigned to? And we said, nobody right now. I said, we just hit Hollabird. We were released for lack of interest.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know where we're going to go.
Mm-hmm.
He called his adjutant over. He said, call the Pentagon in the basement, in the order section,
mm-hmm.
and check these two guys out.
Okay.
So he did, and there's a warrant officer answered and got our names and said, you're right. You know, these two people have just been released from Hollabird, and they're up for grabs. And
okay.
We were immediate members of the 4th Fighter Group at
wow.
that point.
What rank were you at this point, sir?
Both first lieutenant.
Okay. Okay. And so how long did you stay there?
Andrews is about April to November.
Okay.
And we flew the P-47N,
mm-hmm.
which is a version of the D, but it's got clip wings,
mm-hmm.
but it's a little bigger. And then that's where I went and started flying jets, and I checked out in the old F-80 in 1947.
Okay. How did you feel flying the jet versus the prop aircraft?
Oh, that was great. Again, there was stories about the jet. If you were slow or sitting on the ground for
yes,
takeoff,
sir.
You could add full power and it'd take a little while, you know, before the thing would wind up
mm-hmm.
compared to the prop job. When you hit the throttle on a prop job, it jumped in the air after a few hundred feet.
Mm-hmm.
But the jet took a while to wind up. So they kind of scare you there a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, if you ever come around like this bouncing
mm-hmm.
type thing, if you ever come around and turn on the final approach in the jet,
mm-hmm.
ooh, still there?
Yes, sir.
You're going to have to land because the power's back, your speed is down towards a landing or approach speed.
Right.
And by the time you get the power on, you're going to be on the ground, you know, enough power to go anywhere, you're going to be sitting on the ground. So they mentioned crazy things like that, which
uh-huh.
scared a bunch of the older guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, this is great, you know. And we saw a demonstration with a civilian test pilot from Lockheed
uh-huh.
Accompanied our checkout days there.
Uh-huh.
And then we had he flying beside one of our P-47s. And they were come by the grandstand at the same point.
Mm-hmm.
But with a terrible difference in speed.
Right.
So that thrilled the tar out of us.
Uh-huh.
So I got checkout, one of the first, and I found that they were right about the lag in that engine coming
mm-hmm.
up to speed.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as you knew it, you're okay. So I flew that for the rest of that tour at Andrews.
Why were the older hands a little more fearful?
They had a little more experience. And a little more brains, I guess. See, I was still probably about 20. I think I was 20 years old.
That's really amazing. You think of a 20-year-old today, you know, and they're not going to have that kind of experience. You're flying jets in Washington, D.C. at age 20.
That's right.
That's incredible. So you did prefer, I guess once you got in, you preferred the jet to the prop. Was it? How about the maneuverability of the aircraft?
Yeah. They were good. You couldn't tackle a conventional bird like
mm-hmm.
a P-51, a P-47, Navy Corsair, any
mm-hmm.
of these birds. They could turn real tight
mm-hmm.
and they could maneuver well, and they had plenty of power.
Mm-hmm.
And a jet, if you tried to get into a Lufbery, you know, a turn
right.
circle.
Right.
With one, you would start dropping speed, and he would tighten up his turn, and he could have you real quick.
Wow.
So when in the jets, they were plenty maneuverable, you know, for their speed.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you had the power and whatever, and if you had needed a little more speed, you could keep it going downhill.
Mm-hmm.
But the tactics became more of a get up on a high point and that hit and go back up onto the perch, you know, come down and strike and
right.
like a bee.
Right.
And that was a what you ended up in more when you went into the jets.
Okay. This was about the time when the U.S. Air Force was created, is that correct?
Right. Air Force came in 1947.
Okay.
While I was at Andrews.
Okay. So you changed designations. You became part of the U.S. Air Force.
Right.
Okay.
It was established 18 September.
Okay. Okay. And you were there until November, is that
November.
Correct? Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, at this point, how much contact did you have with your family back in Michigan?
Not an awful lot.
Had you been home yet?
Back in, where was it? I had a tour in the hospital.
At Maxwell?
No, let's see, after I got my wings, Craig Beal,
mm-hmm.
and I was going to go to Germany.
Okay.
And it would be in May of 46.
Yes, sir.
And I had a motorcycle, which I wasn't too familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have cars in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And a Marine came in from California with a brand new motorcycle.
Mm-hmm.
And put it in the paper in Selma, Alabama, mm-hmm. for sale for $600. Today, I guess they cost $6,000 or $12,000. And so I bought it, and never knew anything about them. And the day I bought it, I spilled on the highway and tore all my clothes off, busted up the bike. And then about 90 days later, I guess it was, I got the order to go to Germany.
Uh-huh.
And motorcycle was fixed up, and I had driven it several weeks, three or four months or something after that. So I thought I was okay. So
mm-hmm.
a friend of mine, a guy named Armstead, also, let's see, we were second balloons, I think, at that time, second lieutenant. So I was going to ride that thing. He lived in northern Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to drop him off there, and I was going up to Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd sell the bike, and then we'd meet in Germany.
Okay.
And around a little town in Alabama, in the middle of the night, there's an old fella coming in the opposite direction. Had been drinking, and he forced us off the highway,
mm-hmm.
and we hit head on. And so I spent 9 months in the hospital.
Wow. Okay. This is before you went to Andrews.
Yeah. This is. It wasn't long after that when we found out we were going to be released. You know, if we didn't do something, then
mm-hmm.
we went to Hollabird.
Mm-hmm.
We met Colonel Beverly in the fourth group, and I was at that point still kind of recovering.
What happened to you physically?
Oh, I broke the left lower arm. All in radius came through my clothes, and I broke my left femur, the head of it.
Okay.
Crushed that, and also crushed the hip joint.
Wow.
And so I went through about 9 months. And old Red Armstead, dislocated hip was all, so he was out and going within 30 days, and
mm-hmm.
then was discharged right after that. So
sounds like you were lucky to be alive.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so back to Andrews.
Right.
You're there until November. How did you... got your orders to go overseas then, is that correct?
Right. Uh-huh. We, young troops, they keep a, you know, the adjutant, they keep a record of everybody and how long you, if you've ever had an overseas tour,
mm-hmm.
the last one you've had.
Mm-hmm.
And so myself, Tracy Matheson, who joined it with me,
mm-hmm.
and a guy named Bob Andrews, all got orders to go to Okinawa.
Okay.
With the, 51st Fighter Group over there.
Okay.
On Naha, Okinawa, which is on the south tip, southwest, right across from Aishima. where Ernie Pyle was killed.
Yes, sir.
And so we started flying the P-47 again because they went up to 80s. And then it wasn't long, we started flying the 80 again.
Okay.
And I met a bunch of old troops there. Jim Jabera, I don't know if you know, he was, I think, the first Korean ace, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And he's since dead.
He was there in Okinawa?
Yeah, he was on Okinawa,
okay,
along with a bunch of my friends.
Mm-hmm.
And so the tour there, of course, I was single again, and
right,
Jabera and Young and all the guys that went over, and Matheson and Andrews, they were all married. So,
mm-hmm,
but their wives can't accompany them for a year. So
okay,
they had to batch it for a year.
Uh-huh.
And their tour, when you bring your wife over, was something like, I think, 36 months.
Mm-hmm.
And mine, as a bachelor, was 30 months.
Mm-hmm.
And at about the 19th month, the command came out and said 18 months is long enough for bachelors.
Okay.
So I was already eligible to go home. And,
okay.
So I went home. In the meantime, out there for that, 19 months
mm-hmm,
or so, we used to fly to Iwo Jima, Guam, Philippines,
mm-hmm,
places like that, northern Japan.
What were you doing when you flew there? Just getting flight training?
Yeah,
just
flight training, and we had, most of us had a little additional duty of some kind. I don't remember what I had, maybe help the maintenance officer or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I bet it was almost 100% flying. And,
okay.
And we'd go out and shoot, bomb, fill. You had an endless list of things that you had to accomplish every 6 months,
okay,
in order to maintain your qualification, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So every flight we'd take, we had to try to log these various things, whether it was a certain type of a IFR recovery or a
mm-hmm,
certain departure, working with radar or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we would do, filling all that. And shooting, we had to fill those squares. Bombing, we had to fill those.
Mm-hmm.
And then navigation, of course. And then that's when we would go island hopping, 700 miles or so across the water, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we always had B-17s carrying boats underneath in case you had to bail out.
Oh, okay.
And stuff like that.
Okay. How did you feel flying over the water? Was that different for you?
No, wasn't any big problem. We had the seat pack, a dinghy.
Mm-hmm.
You had your parachute, of course, and then you had the dinghy where you had a rubber boat and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then that B-17 was somewhere to within, maybe an hour or so of you, if
mm-hmm,
you had to, if you had to bail out.
Mm-hmm.
So it never bothered me a bit. I never thought that maybe the parachute wouldn't work, or maybe I couldn't get out of the cockpit, or
right,
or whatever, you know, being that young. And to me, it was all just a big kick.
You're still pretty gung-ho at this point.
Oh, yeah.
That's great. What was Okinawa like for you?
Okay, when I hit it, it was, I haven't really been back, but I see pictures and hear people talk, but when we were there, there was nothing. It was, everything is all bombed out. There's a lot of caves,
right,
where the people had hidden. You see a few people out in the field,
mm-hmm,
doing their farming and so on. Nothing more than almost a kind of little grass huts type thing.
Mm-hmm.
Naha, the city, was gone. They had a university or something there was gone. All you could see is the foundations, you know, shells. And we used to ride. I had a friend, a guy named Roland Nichols,
mm-hmm,
had a Jeep, and we'd just ride around all over the island looking at everything and never saw anything other than little huts.
Hmm.
And you always run into the smells where they always had their little open pits and they'd cook.
Mm-hmm.
And some smells are great. You know, you'd smell the wood burning and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a great education. Went over to a point not far from it called Suicide Point.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the Americans cornered all the Japanese.
Right.
and it was a high cliff. And
right.
Japanese by the dozens committed suicide by jumping off.
Right.
And the word was there was a teacher had 600 students and they were in a cave and she talked them all into suicide and they all supposedly killed themselves.
Wow. What did you think of the Japanese?
This is,
of course, right after the war.
Yeah, but I of the individuals there and mm-hmm. of the Japanese in Japan when mm-hmm. they were there,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes TDY, or I always looked at them one-on-one. They're always fine, and that, you know, that bowing from the way Papa-san, Mama-san,
mm-hmm.
how are you? And they'd invite you over to dinner at their home, you know,
mm-hmm.
and things like that, and show their, have their little children play the piano and violins, and,
mm-hmm.
and they seem to really go for that type of thing,
mm-hmm.
Educating these kids in music real young.
Right.
And it was just, I thought, a great experience again all around on in both places.
Right.
All areas, really.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're there for how long? For 19 months?
Yeah, 19 months.
Okay. And... Well, what were your orders after that?
Yeah, I went to, that was May of 49, I went mm-hmm. to Gunnier Field, New Hampshire.
Okay, that's a big difference from Okie to
yes,
New Hampshire.
Yes, and that was the 82nd Fighter Group.
Okay.
And we flew P-51s there, they didn't have jets.
Hmm. Did you miss the jets?
Not really, I guess, because you always figure, you know, you're going to be back.
Right.
And the 51, up to this point, I don't think I'd flown it up to this point. Maybe I had a little bit,
mm-hmm.
but it was a great airplane, so
okay.
I enjoyed that.
Let me ask you, historically at this point, the United States, this is just before the Korean War, and you know, basically we had gone forward with the Marshall Plan in Europe and the Truman Doctrine's out there, and we're really, the United States is establishing itself as... You know, one of the world leaders, of course, opposed to the Soviet Union.
Uh-huh.
How aware were you of all of the communism versus democracy fight that was going on the early years of the Cold War?
Not really. I was, I guess, done fighter jets, and all I wanted to do was fly
mm-hmm.
and go fight a war. There's one around.
Right.
And let's see. One thing I used to. Around Tokyo, you know, we see MacArthur
mm-hmm.
running around in his big, he always had a bunch of motorcycles and squad cars. And
right.
Every time he went from his home to his work, and the Japanese lined up by the hundreds along the route,
mm-hmm.
and bowing, they thought he was some kind of a god.
Right. They called him the White Emperor.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And,
interesting.
I think he really basked in that.
Mm-hmm.
And, but the rest of things, Europe, things like that, we'd hear about the various plans and so on, and
mm-hmm.
trying to put these people back on their feet and all that sort of thing. But
mm-hmm.
I never was too interested too much.
Right.
I was just sorry I missed that actually flying in Europe.
Right.
Or in the Pacific during the
mm-hmm.
the fight.
Mm-hmm. What about the Berlin airlift? That was a huge victory
yes.
for air power. Really, it kind of proved how capable, the Air Force could be.
Yeah, that's right. I remember just where I was during some of that. I was probably over in Europe during some of that time. First time in that area was in January '57. I'm not sure when that airlift ended. Do you remember?
The airlift was in the late 40s, actually.
Late 40s.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
So that was, I think you were in Okinawa at the time.
Yeah. But I flew over a couple times ferrying aircraft. But
mm-hmm.
that was like the late 40s to 1952, probably, flying fighters over to the our fighter troops in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And we heard a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you saw a lot in the papers. And then later, I've driven the route many times, that corridor up in the Berlin, you know.
Yes, sir.
Still before the wall came down, and
right.
that was an experience too.
I bet so. Okay, so you're in New Hampshire. You're there.
Hit there in about June of 49
mm-hmm.
with the 82nd Fighter Group
uh-huh.
flying the Mustang.
Uh-huh.
uh-huh. in that base because everything coming down again because of this butter versus bullets business, you know, and the budget, military budget. So
right.
the word was that that outfit was going to phase out.
Mm-hmm.
It was just very short time. Probably, I guess I was there like 6-7 months. We started firing the airplanes out and giving them to the National Guard in places like Elko, Nevada, and North Dakota, Fargo, North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
I made a couple of those flights, and as airplanes were all dispersed and given away, the base folded. And at that point, again, some of us lost our flying.
Right.
They sent a document around to each individual, and it just said, "I voluntarily request permanent grounding."
Wow.
And that kind of set me back. And then I thought, well, maybe something will happen. You know, I'll go ahead and sign it. And I did. And my next assignment, right after that assignment, the base folded, and they sent me off to actually Langley Field, which was the 4th Fighter Group again.
Okay.
Where I ran into my old flight commander, Jules Young, and Jim DeBera, and all these guys.
Right.
And they said, "Boy, you know, welcome, you know, we're back, we got the gang." And then I said, "Well, I've had it, you know, I lost my client." They said, "Gee, that's too bad." So I ended up just skipping right out of there into a liaison job in Columbus, Ohio, where I oversaw the reserve program and at Fort Hays in Columbus, Ohio.
How did you feel about, you know, being grounded? I mean, was that
terrible?
Yeah,
felt real bad.
But
I thought maybe something would come up, and it did.
Something did right around the corner.
Yeah, that's right.
June 1950,
right.
North Korea invades South Korea. So you're in Ohio until May.
Right.
And May 51. Now, when this happens in the summer of 1950, what are you? You're grounded. You're in Ohio. What are you thinking about? Okay, now this is my chance to get back in, or?
Yes, I begin to figure, you know, something just might come up, and it wasn't long after that a memo came across my desk from my headquarters, which is up in Mitchell Field, New York, and it indicated anybody in my category who desired to go back on flying, all you had to do is go to volunteer for Korea.
Okay.
So I said, I signed it, sent it off, and I was immediately back on flying. So I used to commute to Wright Pat, where I flew P-51s, waiting to go to Korea.
Okay.
And I think I flew a B-25, a couple other birds. One airplane was a kind of a kick. It was a B-29. It was on its last flight before they put it in the mothballs, but they kept tremendous records, and as a captain, and I was a first lieutenant at that point, and he said that he wanted to go on a B-29 flight, and I said, sure. So we took off for, 17 hours or something like that, and this bird, just he and I, normally has a crew of seven, maybe.
Right.
And so we flew around on that bit, and that's what I did for flying until the Korean orders came out.
Right, right.
That was in June 51 I got the order.
Okay. Sir, would you like to take a little break here?
No, fine.
Okay, you're fine?
Good.
Okay, so in June 51 you get your orders and you're shipped to Korea, is that correct?
Right.
Okay, and who were you with?
The 8th Fighter Bomber Group.
Okay.
Which had F-80Cs again.
Okay. And how long were you in the Korean theater?
I was there 8 months, I think it was.
And what did you do there?
Yeah, I flew with the 35th Fighter Squadron to 101 missions in 8 months.
And these are bombing runs?
Yeah, bombing, strafing, napalm, all that type of thing.
Now, this is your first taste of combat.
Right.
How did you feel? Your first taste here of combat.
Good. I never got hit. I got a bullet hole, I guess, in the airplane once, but I never had a problem, and it was just we took off at Kimpo, and which was at the bond line,
mm-hmm.
which meant that by the time you get your wheels in the well, you're in shooting territory, and then we would go to the Chinese border, which is 300 miles north.
Mm-hmm.
So for 300 miles up, 300 miles back, you were targets for the MiGs or the ground fire, and so I got through that. Tracy preceded me a little bit. He got knocked down and broke his back, broke his neck, and was sent home.
Did you have fighter escorts?
Let's see. Normally, we had three squadrons. We had F-80s from the 4th Group, would usually fly top cover.
Mm-hmm.
And then 50, that late 51 or so there, I don't think we'd see a lot of MiGs, but they didn't come down much. They kind of stayed high. I think a lot of them were in training.
Okay.
And F-86s had really raised heck with them in the earlier months. So I think where they just were a little apprehensive as far as popping down too freely.
Right.
But we'd you always hear the radio. The radar people would keep us informed about these guys and tell us how many were in the air in our vicinity and what they were doing, and sometimes who was at the throttle. They had what we called a guy, I think he was Russian, I guess. They called him Casey Jones.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime they got his, they had voice prints, I guess, like we had voice prints of them.
Mm-hmm.
And when they would hear his voice, they would just indicate so many trains out of the station, meaning so many flights of aircraft leaving China.
Mm-hmm.
And then if Casey was at the throttle, they'd always say, Casey Jones at the throttle.
Hmm.
And then that would cinch you up a little bit because you
realize
you had an old pro for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And so that went on daily for all those missions. And we got shot at a lot on the ground because we're bombing all the time. And then, of course, we wouldn't finish bombing as far as the Chinese border, practically. We would have 300 miles on the deck with 1,800 rounds of 50 caliber to expend on the way home for targets of opportunity. It could be vehicles, anything.
You could pick what you wanted to.
Yeah. Everything was open to you. And
were you actually flying the aircraft, or were you co-piloting? Or?
No, they're all single seats.
Okay.
So you're always alone.
Okay.
If you went down, you're alone.
Okay.
So that was a shooting. It's kind of like the old buzzing days, but then you fired and shot up everything, and your cameras and the aircraft are taking pictures.
Mm-hmm.
So you get an idea what kind of damage. Once in a while, something blow up in your face. An ammo dump or a train or something. And and you'd wonder why you didn't inhale some of that debris. And then they used to brief us that you shoot at everything, you know, cattle, because they used to use oxen to haul ammunition.
Right.
But I never sawed out a single cow or something like that. I just didn't have the nerve or guts for that.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd see an individual, and I'd let them go. And they knew, too, walking down the beach, if you're flying by, if you couldn't get your nose on them, you couldn't hit them.
Right.
So they just, I just watch them as I went, and you'd see them just kind of cautiously tiptoeing down the beach.
Right.
And then we'd get tracers on us as we go home. And sometimes you'd have no ammo left, so, and then you always hope that MiGs didn't drop down and catch you between home and in China.
Right.
Because in a lot of cases, you wouldn't have any ammo, and also your fuel is right down to just about nothing. So it was kind of exciting.
It was exciting.
Yeah.
Okay. How many hours round trip was this?
Usually about, I'd say two and a half hours, something like that.
Okay.
We carried tip tanks, large tip tanks, and without them, we couldn't have had half that time.
Okay. And so you did this for how long? For 7 months, 8 months?
Yeah, 8 months.
Okay. And how did you get your orders to leave the theater?
In my outfit, the 8th Fighter Group, mm-hmm. The word was around that you either got 100 missions
mm-hmm.
or a year, I think it was, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, most of the people got 100 missions a lot shorter than a year.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the 51 jocks would get their 100 in maybe 6 months or so, and they were going home, but that was a different outfit.
Right.
And when I got my 101, I thought, well, I'm ready, you know. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, we're going to use you as a assistant operations officer.
Okay.
Until for another couple of months or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And that, the way the word was to all of our guys, so our guys started getting kind of bitter.
Mm-hmm.
And it started coming around to where they were allowing to go home not long after they got their 100 in.
Right. Okay.
And then we just, at that point, you wonder, where are we going from here, you know?
Mm-hmm. Were you disappointed to leave the theater?
No. I tried to go back a couple of times, and they didn't okay it. But
mm-hmm.
It's kind of a, well, you kind of want to get home, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What was your overall impression, sir, of the Korean War, the policy of the United States, and dealing with that uh-huh. peninsula right there on the border of China?
Uh-huh. Again, I was kind of young and loved the flying and type mm-hmm. thing, but we noticed, too, that the natives used to flourish during situations like that. They'd be up around the base with their little newsstands and their soda pop stands and
mm-hmm.
stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was their livelihood.
Right.
And they were, if things going bad, like they're going to leave, they're kind of crushed.
Right.
That kind of set bad with us. We thought, gee, here they're having their country beat up, and they're living on it.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe some of the big industrialists
mm-hmm.
do in a war, and then they're crushed if we had to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And that always didn't set too well with us.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, as young as I was, I didn't think much farther than that, I guess.
You were what, around 26, 25?
Yeah, I was just come up 25, I think, then.
Okay. So from Korea, you went back stateside.
Yeah.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Went to February of 52, went to Truex Field in Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
which is an F-86 outfit.
Mm-hmm.
And I was with the 432nd Fighter Interceptor Squadron, which was air-to-air type, you
mm-hmm.
know, the type of thing I would have liked to have done in Korea
mm-hmm.
and World War II. But,
right.
That I ended up fighter bombers all the time, so I'm air ground wherever I go,
mm-hmm.
including Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But so I spent 5 years there, and flew 86F in the 86D, which was an all weather type bird, where you you seek the guy out in the air in weather
mm-hmm.
and under radar control and get him with rockets.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a kind of new and fun too.
Right. This is basically learning dogfighting tactics and
right.
and all of that.
Uh huh.
And that's what you'd want to do for a long time.
Sure.
Yeah.
From the time I flew, when we actually got into tactical birds, the P-40
mm-hmm.
on,
mm-hmm.
that's all you did. You went up and fought all the time. And
right.
And to the point, sometimes you get such a stomach ache, side ache, you'd have to maybe quit. Because you're pulling so many G's.
Right, right.
And,
did you find that really difficult for you to learn these tactics? And
no. It was just kind of a matter of eyesight, you know, spot the other guy
mm-hmm.
first
mm-hmm.
and try to get an altitude advantage if you could on him and or where he may not sight you at all
mm-hmm.
and then try to get in behind him.
Okay. When did you meet Jody?
Met Jody in San Francisco, and the fall of 59 to early 60, January 60.
Okay, so we're not there yet.
No.
Okay, all right, so you're there in 5 years in Wisconsin.
Right.
You're close to home. Did you get to go home much?
No, I flew over once, kind of looked them over, you know, 86, mm-hmm. yeah, but and saw my cousins out in the country and out there by their home, you know, and they mm-hmm. they commented, wrote a letter, said they saw me.
Right.
But didn't see my dad died in 59.
Mm-hmm.
See 59. Yeah, he was still alive then. So, but I just didn't get home much other than a leave maybe between assignments.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And from Wisconsin, where did you go?
From Wisconsin, I went to...
This is January 1957.
Yeah, I went back to Germany.
Okay.
Yeah, I went to Erding Air Station at Munich, Germany,
mm-hmm.
which was a real plush deal. I flew with a 440, a 440
mm-hmm.
Fighter Interceptor Squadron flying the F-86D again, which was... along the Iron Curtain, scrambling on unknowns coming over from the east.
Right.
And that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Intercepted a couple of birds on that deal, but they always ended up being okay
mm-hmm.
airliners.
What do you remember most about that tour?
That tour? I guess Munich itself.
Mm-hmm.
The great town had great food. Some real fine restaurants,
mm-hmm.
flying again, met some new troops,
mm-hmm.
Didn't stay there very long because of a new assignment that came up.
Which was what?
A place in Toul, France, the 50th Fighter Bomber Group wanted
mm-hmm.
flight commanders,
mm-hmm.
and they were flying F-86H. Which is a real bomb, real beautiful bird. I believe it had a Rolls-Royce engine in it. And
mm-hmm.
they were going into the F-100B,
mm-hmm.
which would be the first century bird that came out, and I hadn't flown that yet. And when I heard that there was looking for volunteers for that particular deal,
mm-hmm.
I took it. So I was at Erding from May until October only.
Mm-hmm.
And then October, I checked... January to May.
Right.
And then in May, I checked in at Toul-Rosay Air Base.
May 1957, yeah.
Right.
Okay. And you were there for what, a couple of years?
Yeah, I was there for the rest of my tour.
And you did flight training and you trained in the F-100D?
Yes, I flew 86 for a while. We used to fly down to Tripoli,
mm-hmm.
Libya. That was where we had a range. Called El Watia.
Mm-hmm.
That was our range, which was a European range for all fighters in Europe,
hmm.
and including England.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd go down there to fill our strafing and bombing
mm-hmm.
squares. And that was nice. It was a 1,200 nautical miles, I guess,
mm-hmm.
down along the Italy and
mm-hmm.
through Switzerland, Italy, and into North Africa.
Right.
And while I was into the H, they came up with the F-100B,
mm-hmm.
and so I ended up checking some of the people out. I checked out in Casablanca.
Okay.
The reason Casablanca, the 20th Wing had a checkout school for their people
mm-hmm.
in Casablanca,
mm-hmm.
in North Africa. And the 20th was in England. And here we were in France, but
mm-hmm.
The fact that they had a program going,
mm-hmm.
they would ship us down by a courier of some kind. And a guy named Charlie Tubbs, we set up our little detachment. We had maybe a half a dozen D's.
Mm-hmm.
And our guys would come down in a courier, and we'd check them out and after we checked out, got all squared away. So we went through that deal until we had like 30, maybe 40 pilots all checked out.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd all end up back at Tool flying regularly.
Right.
And then we would continue to fly, you know, down to North Africa at Lwatia range.
Mm-hmm.
Every few weeks or months,
mm-hmm.
in order to keep all of our squares filled.
Right.
So I ended up spending a lot of time in North Africa.
Hmm.
I think of the 6 years in fighters down there, this period, this one and the one coming up,
mm-hmm.
and all these short hops,
mm-hmm.
ended up a year of it was spent in North Africa.
Okay.
So at that, I spent that up until October of 59 there.
Mm-hmm.
The 50th group, I was an ops officer of the 10th Fighter Bomber Squadron.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a bunch of nice guys.
Yeah. And you were transferred stateside after that, is that?
I just bought a 300 SL Mercedes. That,
oh, really? Okay.
That gull wing type, you know.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And so I shipped that home, and I took the, I don't remember, I guess I went to London, and I probably went to the British, our British base,
mm-hmm.
I think of the name of it, and launched out of there in a military bird.
Mm-hmm.
And went back, and let's see. And I went to Hamilton. That's where I met Jody.
Okay, Hamilton Air Force Base in California.
Right.
Okay, and that's when you met Jody.
October 49.
Mm-hmm.
I flew with the 4th Air Force again, which was an IG type thing where they evaluate all the National Guard and Reserve units on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
So I became a member of that team, which you're inspector and check pilot. So
mm-hmm.
I maintained currency in a T-33, all F-86s and F-100s in
okay.
order to fly with these people to see how they do. So I was only there a year. I met Jody, and I ended up in the... end of 59, around October, November,
mm-hmm.
getting orders to go, January 61,
mm-hmm.
getting orders to go to Maxwell,
okay.
which is the Air Command and Staff College.
Right.
And at that point, we'd only known each other a short time,
mm-hmm.
and but we copied our each other's addresses and so on. She went to Hawaii
mm-hmm.
for a year or so, and I went to Air Command Staff College, where I spent a year at school and a few months on the base getting ready to go to school.
Okay.
And so I left there and I hit max on January 61
mm-hmm.
and left in June of 62.
How was that experience for you there at Maxwell?
At Maxwell?
Uh-huh.
It was good. It was real good. We went into everything regarding military command,
mm-hmm.
What we could expect in the future, and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of speech and writing,
mm-hmm.
and that type of thing. And then, I flew before I went into the school, which would maybe be 60, 90 days, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I flew like crazy all over the country.
Oh, yeah?
And flying the T-33, which is an F-82 seater.
Mm-hmm.
And being a bachelor, I used to, they'd have my name. And anytime anybody wanted to go anywhere, day or night, anywhere in the country, they'd
mm-hmm.
give me a call and I'd go. So I filled up a lot of time there.
Right, right.
And then I finished that course. And then you wait for them to get you in the auditorium and read the list mm-hmm. where you go.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess we had maybe 250, 300 troops in that. They're all captains or majors, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I was a captain. Yeah, I think I was a captain. Yeah, I was a captain.
You're captain by the time.
No, let's see, Hamilton. No, I made major at Hamilton.
Okay.
So I was a major.
Okay.
And then in January 61, let's see, no, June of 62,
mm-hmm.
I got the word to go to the 31st TAC Fighter Wing at Homestead Air Force Base here in Miami.
Okay.
And I've been, see, Jody was already here. She'd been here 5 or 6 months, and it just happened that Miami, New York, L.A., places like that were some of the places that she wanted to hit
mm-hmm.
while she was single and free.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't any coordinated type deal, although it might look like it. So I ended up here in June of 62 flying with the squadron. Flying the F-100D again.
Uh-huh.
And I was chief of the command post,
uh-huh.
Which monitors all the squadrons and all the airplanes.
Right.
And that's when the Cuban thing broke out.
Right,
and
right.
It really got hairy.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, you're right down there in the middle of this. What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, that was...
October 62.
Yeah, we had just the... at that point, we had the three squadrons of the 305, 6, 7,
mm-hmm.
and one of them, maybe 304, one of them was in Japan,
mm-hmm.
setting nuclear targets, which we, in Russia, which mm-hmm. we, was one of our commitments. So the squadrons used to, each squadron would rotate over there every 90 days.
Right.
And so we had one squadron over there and three here, and we got a tremendous ramp for parking because it was a SAC base.
Mm-hmm.
They had B-52s and their tankers.
Mm-hmm.
And a guy named Catton, Brigadier Catton, was the SAC commander. And the orders came out to bring in the fighters. So, boy, the fighters came in from everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Like the birds from the north. And, they just filled that that ramp.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack Catton got the word from the Pentagon to take his SAC birds and relocate somewhere. So he left with all of the SAC birds, and then we became a TAC base, tactical air instead of strategic.
Mm-hmm.
And so, my gosh, I don't know what we had, 400 or 500 fighters out there.
Wow.
And I had the command post, like I mentioned, and then we had another command post set up adjacent to us
mm-hmm.
with a major general, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a brigadier popping in us all the time. And all we maintained all the numbers on the boards
mm-hmm.
and kept in contact with everybody and waiting for someone to tell us to kick the airplanes off. And this thing went on until the ships, President Kennedy turned them around out there in the east,
right.
The Atlantic. And at that point, everything kind of fizzled like a letting the air out of a balloon,
mm-hmm.
and the airplane just left here by the droves, and we went back to our normal 31st TAC Fighter Wing operation.
Okay. Okay. We're nearing the point where you're going to be dispatched to Benoit overseas, but first you're moved in April 64 to the United Kingdom.
Right.
From Homestead in Florida.
Right.
And yeah. what was your assignment there?
At
Weathersfield?
Weathersfield.
Yes, sir.
Just a note, while at Homestead there,
mm-hmm.
of course, Jody and I, through correspondence, were able to make contact.
Right.
And I lived here in a motel in Homestead.
Mm-hmm.
And she lived in with a family up in Miami, which is about 20 miles.
Mm-hmm.
So we commuted a little bit, started dating and
mm-hmm.
dated for a while. And then during that Cuban thing, we ran into the Methodist church in Homestead and got married.
During the crisis?
Yeah. And I took about an hour off to get married. And
you took an hour off to get married?
Yeah. And then turned around and went back.
Okay.
And we had been building a house.
Uh-huh.
Neither one of us talking marriage at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And it was finished shortly after.
Mm-hmm.
Right here in what is called Perrine, which is South Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So then we were married, and then I went on. I got the orders for RAF Weathersfield
right.
in April.
Right.
And Jody, kind of young, and she thought, gee, you know, I don't know whether I want to go off and leave this country again, you know, short of home or short of Hawaii or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, come on. You know, a lot of the women are like that.
Right.
I said, you'll enjoy it. So we popped off, and we had our 300 SL, just
mm-hmm.
the two of us.
Mm-hmm.
I joined up with the 20th TAC Fighter Wing
mm-hmm.
at Weathersfield
mm-hmm.
and became ops officer of the 10th Fighter Squadron. And again, the routine was set nuke targets. I don't remember too much on the target business, but we had the nuke target business there in Weathersfield too.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then we made our regular runs to North Africa.
Again to North Africa.
Right, F-100Ds.
Mm-hmm.
And that went on for 2 years. And I made lieutenant colonels in there, along there, and then they made me deputy DO of the wing.
Okay.
Under a nice full bird. And it went on for a while, and then I got the assignment in Frankfurt, Germany.
At this point, the United States became involved in the Vietnam War really heavily in the summer of 1965. What did you think of U.S. policy at this point? Were you aware? I mean, I'm sure you were, but what were you thinking about?
In Vietnam?
Yeah, what the United States was doing in Southeast Asia.
I was kind of busy and flying a lot, thing I loved to do,
mm-hmm.
doing a lot of sightseeing and things like that. And I never really thought too much other than I'd probably be over there for long.
You did think that the war was brewing and that you would be there?
Yeah, I wanted to get over there.
Even with your new wife, you wanted to get over?
Yeah, I knew that she'd have to sit for a year.
Mm-hmm.
But it worked okay.
Yes, sir.
So, at Frankfurt, I ended up an air liaison officer in the IG Farben building. IG Farben was a big industrialist during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fabulous building. We call it the Little Pentagon. It was strictly Army. The 5th Army Corps,
mm-hmm.
it was their headquarters, and the three-star General Mather.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was his liaison with the Air Force.
Okay. This is May 1966 when you arrive in
right.
Germany.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And that lasted about a year.
Right.
And I just had an office. And
did Jody go with you to Germany?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, she was with me in England,
mm-hmm.
lived on the base. And then we went over to Germany, and we lived in nice quarters, not far from the base.
Mm-hmm.
They called it High Cog. It was where a lot of the diplomats stayed.
Mm-hmm.
And we went back. We've picked it up since. See if it's still there. And she enjoyed it. After she got over, England was great.
Mm-hmm.
Germany was great. And Germany, of course, with that 300 SL, we could drive all over Europe on a weekend. We'd hit from Oslo, Norway to Switzerland.
Wow.
No problem. The thing with cruise at 120.
Wow.
So it was a nice car.
Right, right. So how did you get your orders to go to Vietnam? Were you expecting this to happen?
Let's see. I don't remember whether somebody called me, because I was in Frankfurt then,
mm-hmm.
in the office. And my 3-year period was
mm-hmm.
coming to an end. And, maybe it was one of the other senior ALOs or something up the way. That gave me the word, but I thought, gee, that's great. And so we jumped, we entered the S USS United States, the big ship, mm-hmm. with the car and everything, and we went to the East Coast, Ben Juan, was that in May, about May of 67.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jody and I both drove the 300 out to California.
Okay.
And I think of the base. And, then they sent me to survival school at in Washington State.
Okay.
That town has been on the news here.
Tacoma?
Tacoma.
Yes, sir.
And there's an air base there, and I went to...
Fort Lewis, is that right?
Yeah, well, it was an Air Force base.
Air Force base, right.
Yeah.
Of course.
So Jody stayed in the DOQ, I think,
mm-hmm.
officer's quarters,
mm-hmm.
and I went to this thing where you live on the land for a week or two. And
this is in case you're shot down in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they show you how to eat berries and birds and angleworms. Things like that.
Right.
And so then finished that, came back about 20 pounds lighter and and picked up Jody, went to the air base at Washington. I'm trying to think of that air base. It's a big jump-off base for the Far East.
Mm-hmm.
McCord.
Okay, McCord, that's right. McCord Air Force Base.
Right.
Uh-huh.
So I met my time, departure time, and Jody took off
mm-hmm.
Back. She drove the 300 back down to her folks around L.A. and
mm-hmm.
Bakersfield, and then all alone all the way back to Homestead.
Wow.
And no big problem. And,
right.
So I put, with the 3rd Attack Fighter Wing, I spent 1 year, May 67, May 68, flying the F-100D again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How was that flight over for you? From
flying over there?
Yeah, going to Vietnam, yes, sir.
No problem. I'm trying to think. I think it was a commercial bird
mm-hmm.
because they were under contract because of the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Normally we'd fly in a 141, C-141
right,
or
right.
C-5. Now a C-17, I think it is. But,
mm-hmm.
but I think I went in a... And a stretch, whatever they had at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And
what was the mood on the plane flying over?
Oh, just like any flight in an airliner, I guess.
Okay.
Just like you're around the state, just matter of fact, here we go. You
mm-hmm.
know.
How did you feel going back into a war zone?
Good. We went into Tantanut.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there at the capital. And that's where 7th Air Force is located.
Right.
Under General Lomar.
Right.
And let's see, right in Saigon. So
mm-hmm.
At that point, you know, you got off and there's sandbags and all the military hubbaloo, so no doubt you're in a combat
mm-hmm.
situation.
What was your impression of Vietnam when you stepped off the plane?
Just another experience, a little bit like Okinawa, I guess. A place I'd never been,
mm-hmm.
busy,
mm-hmm.
and all business, serious.
Mm-hmm.
And my thought was, let's get on with it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Benoit, my air base, was just a short hop north up the road.
Yes, sir.
And so I jumped in a 130, and it was about a 10 minutes, I guess,
mm-hmm.
and I was on the deck at Benoit, and I don't know who met me or if I went to, maybe I probably went to base ops or
mm-hmm.
looked for the wing somewhere there,
mm-hmm.
and then they know you're coming, so
right.
Everything was fine. I got squared away, and I was assistant to the deputy of operations, which is a man that's in charge of all the pilots and fighters,
mm-hmm.
and a guy named Corey, Bob
okay.
Corey,
uh-huh.
real fine guy. George McLaughlin was a wing commander, and
mm-hmm.
In fact, at that time, I think it was another man. And I ended up most of my time under George McLaughlin, and I had that deputy DO for a while, mm-hmm. waiting to take over the 90th. tactical mm-hmm. fighter squad,
mm-hmm.
and which is about 25 birds and 30, 40 pilots.
Right.
And F-100s again, Bs.
Mm-hmm.
And we milled around every day at that point, living in tents, you know, type thing.
Mm-hmm.
Food was tolerable, and just checking out everything, runways.
Right.
Everything's operating right. And then it wasn't long, a friend of mine, a guy named Bill Haynes,
mm-hmm.
we were both lieutenant colonels,
mm-hmm.
and I had a little more fighter time experience than he did,
mm-hmm.
and so he wasn't marked for anything that I know of at that point, but I'd been for quite some time then,
mm-hmm.
waiting to take over this 90th, and I was, the fact that I was going to take over, I flew with him. And so I got to know the troops, the maintenance guys, and the pilots and
mm-hmm.
everything,
mm-hmm.
which makes for a more comfortable takeover.
Right.
And then one day, after this thing gone long for quite a while,
mm-hmm.
My buddy walked up to me and said, "You hear the great news?" And I said, "No, what was that?" That was, Bill. And Haynes, the guy that that didn't have an assignment, he says, "I'm taking the 90th."
Okay.
And I hadn't heard anything, and I thought, "Gee, what did I do, or what happened?"
Right. You were expecting that come in.
Yeah. And but I was busy and out trotting around on the runway somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And Corey had popped the news to him,
mm-hmm.
and then so I finally got back to Corey, and then Corey told me, he said, "Well, you got the 531st. And then I thought, good deal. You know,
right.
at least I got a squadron.
Right.
And not the one I thought I was going to get.
Right.
So that turned out that they had fired two squadron commanders in a fairly short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
One for cause,
mm-hmm.
and the other one just had nothing to do with him, really. The airplane just began to not come home. And
they blame the guy at the top. He took responsibility.
Yeah, when that happens, you get in deep water.
Right.
So the fact that I'd had more fighter time and been in more wings and whatever than most,
mm-hmm.
they gave it to me. So
okay.
I ended up going down there with these guys.
Right.
And turned out as a real, I thought, in the wing commander and all, that was the best squad in the event.
Right.
So,
okay, sir, I'd like to ask you a question about overall U.S. policy at this point. Why did you think the United States, or what did you think, what were you being told, I guess, of why the United States was in Vietnam?
Yeah, the big thing, I guess, contained communism and
mm-hmm.
saved that country, but
mm-hmm.
I don't know. Again, I never delved into anything in any depth. In my case,
mm-hmm.
at both of our troops,
mm-hmm.
The DOD and president and all of those troops,
mm-hmm.
you know, set the policy and everything. And
right.
We were always chomping at the bit to you know, get in there and do what we're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that was kind of a sorry way to look at it, but I never really went much beyond my duty.
Right.
I enjoyed what we were doing, but it just didn't work out.
How would you judge the overall morale of the U.S. troops there that you encountered?
Yeah, everybody around me, I never had any problem at all.
Mm-hmm.
It was just like in Europe during peacetime, you know,
mm-hmm.
you got all these troops, you got the aircraft, you got missions to fly, maintenance and all that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
And all you hope for is, you know, have everything to run smoothly.
Right. How many aircraft did you have there with the 531st?
The 531st and about 27.
Yeah, these are F-100Ds?
Right.
Okay.
They used a squadron that usually had about 25 plus a couple of spares.
Mm-hmm.
And spares sometimes are the two-seater, the F-100F. Mm-hmm. It's a tandem setup where you can fly somebody in the back seat.
Right. Okay. And what was your daily routine? Would you get your briefing on where you needed to go, the target list, and then fly sorties all day?
Yes. Every day we had our operations building down on the flight line, our birds all lined up, and at a command post, they would come up with the frag orders usually early in the morning,
mm-hmm.
and they'd send them down to the various squadrons, and you'd have these pre-planned missions, which the Army asks for,
mm-hmm.
through the tactical net that's set up between the Army and the Air Force,
mm-hmm.
including our air liaison officers, you know.
Right.
Sit there and talk with their commanders, and they may have a certain thing they're kicking off at a certain time under certain latitude, longitude type thing, a certain
mm-hmm.
fix, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a couple of attack and fight so that we could work off of those, the pinpoint location.
Right.
And they would load the airplanes up right after getting that frag order for whatever the mission might be, whether it's 500 pounders, napalm. Always carried a full load of 20 millimeter cannon
mm-hmm.
Ammunition. And we just be where those frag orders told us to be at a certain time, and talking to a certain pack,
mm-hmm.
is airborne troops and the little airplane who would direct you in, you know.
Yes, sir.
And in my case, of course, all of my shooting was in the south,
mm-hmm.
and we didn't go up north where we got all the air ground or the air to air stuff or
mm-hmm.
ground air stuff,
mm-hmm.
where we lost so many people.
Right.
But we got shot at, and we'd primarily on bombing missions and strafing, and where we would catch sampans in the little back streams,
mm-hmm.
and troops build up of troops or build up of ammunition and things
mm-hmm.
like that. So we did a lot of shooting and bombing that way,
mm-hmm.
and we'd also accompany drops where the transport birds would go in and supply our troops out in the middle of nowhere in these little encampments, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We would get with a FAC and with that the pilots of these slow-going multi-engine jobs, and we'd just maintain cover, and if we see any activity,
mm-hmm.
enemy activity, then we could shoot them up. And also the what's that green defoliage
mm-hmm.
thing?
Agent Orange?
Agent Orange.
Yes,
when they go in, we would follow them up out of the way a little bit, maybe
mm-hmm.
a couple thousand feet until they got through,
mm-hmm.
and then we go home.
Just providing cover for them.
Right.
Did your plane ever get shot, actually have damage done to it?
No, I don't know of any hit that I got. Sometimes you may have had something you didn't know, but
mm-hmm.
I never got anything, but... we lost a few guys.
From ground fire?
Yeah, ground fire.
Mm-hmm.
These are
men under you.
Under me,
mm-hmm.
I didn't lose anybody.
Okay.
But before I came in, we had a young boy went down. He was recovered okay.
Mm-hmm.
And his was a maintenance area where had a problem with his oil, and the engine froze, and he bailed out.
Mm-hmm.
And they picked him up the chopper and brought him back. He was all right.
When you would get these, the orders were basically your targets from the facts.
Uh-huh.
And after you drop your load, I guess you would go back to Benoit immediately, or
yeah.
Did you have any orders or that you had to dispense of your load no matter what, or
no, just to dump it, you mean, more or less?
Yes, sir.
No, in Korea we used to come back and just pound away with our 50 calibers,
mm-hmm.
1800 rounds, because with your bombs and everything gone, and all of that ammo in the nose, it
mm-hmm.
was heavy.
Yes.
And sometimes it was hard to keep the nose off, and you landed, you might hit the nose first, you know.
Okay.
But in Vietnam, in Korea then, we would make a point of getting rid of it, that ammunition, but we always found good targets.
What kind of targets would you use? Well, was this up to your discretion, or would you go through the FAC to get these targets?
Yeah, in the with the FAC, we'd stick with him, and usually would use up everything we had. We'd make a couple of bomb runs, and then he'd say, now can you hit 3 o'clock about 300 yards or something, you know, in that clump of growth.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd say, fine. So we'd go in and chop that up with a 20-millimeter cannon.
Mm-hmm.
And we had 4 in each bird. And but we never, I don't think we ever went home, you know, looking for a target, because we'd pretty much expended everything right there with that FAC.
Okay.
Then he would give us that battle damage assessment, you know, BDA.
Right.
And tell us how many arms he counted in the trees and stuff like that.
Oh, really? Okay, so you would, how soon after would you get that information?
He'd say, stand by, you know, a couple of minutes, and he'd go on down, and we'd maybe make a one orbit or so, getting ready to head out to Benoit. And then he'd come back with so many bodies, so many bunkers, so many vehicles, or whatever. And I think one time somebody asked him, he says, how can you tell how many bodies, you know, it's such explosives? And he says, I just count the arms and count by, divide by 2.
I guess that works.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Because I guess it's a mess. That's one thing with the pilots. You don't see that gore, you know, like the Army guys do, unless you are shot down.
Mm-hmm.
And you end up gore. But,
Right. That's what I wanted to ask you about. You you never saw really the results firsthand of the bombing and everything.
No, I don't think in Korea and here I saw our own guys.
I'm sorry?
I have to pause.
Okay. Okay, go ahead,
sir. Yeah, we were spared to that. That was good. I went out once, the 10th, to see the Big Red One. Infantry division was near us.
They were stationed, what, just north of you?
Yeah, they were a little northwest of us.
Mm-hmm.
And they lived, they had set up around a French a rubber plantation.
Mm-hmm.
And, we used to exchange visits. They'd come over, their colonels, you know, and we'd fly them in the back seat of the F and show them what we did and show them their place, their areas and things. And then we would jump, they'd come over with a chopper, an Army chopper, and pick us up, you know, one at a time, and they'd bring us out to the to their old plantation there that they all shot up, and we'd spend the night in a cot, and then they'd take us out that night and show us, or the next morning, and show us the DC bed that they'd mailed the night before.
Right.
And the day before, and that was interesting.
See, they'd actually walk you out at night.
No, they'd take us in during daylight hours.
Okay. Okay.
And, usually, I think when I went, last time I went in, it'd be something like maybe 8 or 9 in the morning, and the troops, our guys, are just they're laying around in all the rubble and stumps and everything, and shaving and the sun and they're drinking eating an orange or something, you know, just. Dispersed all over the area, and then there was always the perimeter guards. They were standing around a certain distance apart with machine guns and everything. And I remember the colonel that I visited. He said, "What are you carrying?" And I was in my flying suit and boots. And I thought I got a 38 Smith and Wesson, and he laughed and he said, "Don't worry about that." And he handed me 2 hand grenades, and he said, "Hang on to these," and he says, "If you see anything or hear anything there," he said, "just drop one in there."
Oh, really?
So we now, looked at...
You're on the ground or in the helicopter?
Yeah, we're on the ground.
Okay.
And getting ready to go down into the brush, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And no problem identifying our guys because they were all in the open with their military gear and rifles and everything. Their
right.
M16 machine gun. And we go down... see some of the bodies, and most of the bodies they carry away, but there'd be some laying around bloated. You're always worried about maybe they're booby trapped or something.
Right.
So
Why did the colonel want to show you the bodies, do you think?
Oh, I guess just to show you what they did every day,
mm-hmm.
you know, what it was all about. And they'd never want more than one ride in the airplane, either.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That was enough for them.
Yeah, because when you go out, everything is bang, 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 fast and
mm-hmm.
furious.
Mm-hmm.
And you join up with your flight of three, you're flying through artillery. You got to know where the artillery is in the air, you know,
mm-hmm.
the channels,
mm-hmm.
and you stay away from those,
mm-hmm.
and then you pick up your FAC out there somewhere, and I mean, it's just talk, 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 and
mm-hmm.
Turn here, turn there, dive, climb, and then when you get in the target, it's the three of you in a circle,
mm-hmm.
about 130 degrees apart, and you're got your guns and bombs hot and everything, and you're throwing stuff all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time you get back, you don't realize much, but this guy in the back seat, you know, just about to get sick, maybe, from all that. You know, you
right.
pull out a G, too.
Mm-hmm.
So then they usually get back and say, well, that's enough of that.
When you were on the ground there with the ground troops, how do they treat you? How were you received?
Oh, fine.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, the guys... is like, geez, I don't know, like somebody walk in a supermarket,
mm-hmm.
and you got the people, the handlers, they're stacking the shelves and
mm-hmm.
stuff, you know, and things like that,
mm-hmm.
and they come walking in with someone off the street or something, and you just mm-hmm. kind of walk through, they look up at you, ignore you, and it's
mm-hmm.
just calm and cool.
Okay.
But all blown to pieces, usually, just struggle, or everything... shredded and torn and
mm-hmm.
potholes and stinky
mm-hmm.
water and stuff like that.
Right. Would you say that the morale was pretty good? Or
yeah. I never heard of any problem. Never talked much with the Army guys, you know,
mm-hmm.
the officers.
Mm-hmm.
We had I'd hear on TV sometime, I don't know if it's the news or maybe some Hollywood thing, and
mm-hmm.
they're always talking about all these drugs and stuff like that. I
mm-hmm.
never heard of anything like that myself with our air guys.
Right.
Could have been different out there in the tulees,
mm-hmm.
sleeping in the mud.
So you didn't see a lot of alcohol abuse or
no,
drug abuse?
No. We had an officers club and a little squadron deal there. We could pop in for a drink
mm-hmm.
if you wanted one. Native, like out in the island type thing, you know,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, casual, no problem, no drinkers, no carrying on, or I want to go home, or
mm-hmm.
that type of thing.
So you guys were squared away.
Yeah, everything,
yeah.
We put in our year, and
mm-hmm.
of course we got hit with rockets.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. That's really is that pretty much, besides being shot at a few times in the
yeah.
air, that was the only enemy fire you came under.
Yeah, they dropped these, I think they're 122-millimeter, they look like a telephone pole.
Mm-hmm.
And they would launch those at us from out in the tulees. And it's a real simple setup where they just line them up on you
mm-hmm.
out there at a certain angle from the knowledge that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll maybe take six or a dozen of them side by side, and they get all ready, and you got them all set up about anywhere from midnight to 3 or 4 in the morning,
mm-hmm.
they would touch them off. And here they'd come, you know,
mm-hmm.
6 to 12 of these things. They'd land in around the base, burn airplanes, bus holes in the taxiways or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I had one troop picked up a little flak in the neck from one of them.
Okay.
And it'd shake out of bed, and you'd jump out, go jump in a bunker until
mm-hmm.
They were finished. The tower would sit and watch, and
mm-hmm.
When they think launch, you get that telltale
mm-hmm.
flame behind them.
Right.
And the tower guy would hit the siren, and you'd have 6 or 12 inbound.
Mm-hmm.
And if he didn't see them, then the first thing you'd get is an explosion.
Right. Did you ever see anyone killed by these rockets?
No, we had one of the pilots could have kissed it. It hit so close. He was going into, it was at night, he was going into the operations annex, right, where we kept the parachutes and so on, and this thing hit right beside him. He could almost touch it.
Wow.
And it hit, instead of hitting the concrete, it hit a little mud triangular spot there.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it buried and then blew up.
Hmm.
If it had hit the concrete, then it blows out
at
360 degrees and clips everything. And
it
knocked him down. It kind of blew him into the shed. He didn't get hurt.
Wow.
But that was about it.
How often would these rocket attacks occur?
Oh, the last couple of months is maybe four times a week.
Okay, that's pretty often.
Yeah.
You were there during the Tet Offensive.
I was.
Yeah. Yes.
I was inbound to the base. I was away that night.
Mm-hmm.
And So I'd come in that morning after things had settled down. I think I have my TV guy at the door.
Oh, okay.
Can you hold it?